This is Bob Lang with the Oral History Project of the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Today is December 8th, 2009. This is another session in the ongoing oral history interview with Senior Associate Dean Frank Kustra of CALS. Frank, we wanted to pick it up today from a campus perspective, beginning with the most significant campus-wide activities you've been involved in, committees that you have served on.
Okay. Well, over the years, it's been quite a number. I think some of the, committee work is kind of sporadic. I think the most memorable would be the Academic Staff Committee and eventually the Academic Staff Executive Committee, the Academic Staff Assembly. Those were all, I think, highlights. I served on a university search and screen committee that brought Darryl Bazell to campus. I served on many search and screen committees at the college, but that was the one university search committee that I was on.
What was that like, Frank?
Very, very interesting. Very interesting.
This is, what, about 4 years ago?
Yeah, right about then, 4 or 5 years ago. That's about as long as Darryl Bazell has been here. The committee was chaired by Walter Hickey.
Walter Hickey or Dickey?
Dickey, sorry.
From the law school.
Yeah, from the law school. The short list boiled down to three candidates, and there was one finalist, a female, that I was very high on. She had a background at Ohio State University, came up through the ranks, went to Loyola, and was at Wright State, had an excellent budget officer pedigree. The committee, once they had to deliberate on the five finalists, ended up sending only two to the chancellor for as candidates, and she was eliminated.
Was Wiley the chancellor? Then?
I think it was Ward. Probably Wiley. No, I think it was Wiley, yeah. Mm-hmm. I found that absolutely interesting because some of her strongest critics within the committee were female. And I really was trying to, first of all, I knew her to be very capable mm-hmm. and had a strong budget officer background, which is what we were after.
Right.
And I didn't understand why we couldn't submit three. The chancellor had asked for 3 to 5.
Really?
Yeah. So we ended up submitting two, and I found that to be quite interesting.
And who made that decision?
The committee.
To send just
mm-hmm.
two?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we had a nice pool. We had two very capable male candidates. Of course, Darryl Bazell was ultimately selected, and he was a minority candidate. Uh-huh. And I like to say something about that when we finish with this as well. So what's wrong with a gender diversity? The internal workings of a search committee is absolutely fascinating. Absolutely fascinating.
Is there pressure on those search committees in the sense that there is perhaps a favored candidate?
Who knows what's going on in the people in the back of people's mind, but obviously, you know, one of the games that you play is it's sort of like a reality game where you try to eliminate sort of the competition, isn't it? I find that absolutely amazing how all that works. So I don't know what's going on in people's mind, but in the end, she was not forwarded as a candidate.
Did you speak up for her
in
committee?
Yeah.
And what was said against her?
Didn't know Wisconsin came from the outside. Obviously, the interview process, I mean, that formulates an opinion in people's mind. I thought she interviewed okay, but maybe, and only maybe, the Darryl Bazell's interview influenced people. You know, the background there, and I find this absolutely amazing. We had a lot of candidates for this position. I don't know the exact number, but it was approaching 100, somewhere between 80 and 100.
Because this was the job John Torfey had, is that correct?
This is the job that John Torfey had, right. Okay. So the first screening of the applicants is pretty easy because you have 85, 90 candidates, and you know, you have those that are absolutely unqualified. Somebody just graduated from college and they want, you know, a position as the vice chancellor for budget at the University of Wisconsin. Well, you can weed out 50 to 60% right there. Mm-hmm. And that narrows the list down. And that was fairly easy. Darryl made that cut very easy. He was, at the time, the secretary of the DNR. Mm-hmm. And under sort of the Republican regime. Mm-hmm. And it was pretty obvious. By then, Thompson had gone off to Washington. And so it was fairly obvious that there was probably going to be a political party shift in the governor's office. But that wasn't really known at that time. It was right in that transition. So when we got down to the final cut, Darryl wasn't all that serious early on. His letter of application and maybe even his resume just wasn't that polished. But we all knew who he was, and so, you know, you kept that one in the go pile. And when it finally came down to we interviewed, I think it was 6 or 8. I can't remember. It was either we interviewed the final 6 or maybe we had 8 in that final interview. And Darryl just made it into that, in my mind. You know, you vote. You know, you go through this committee process. Darryl Bazell got in front of the search committee in an interview and blew everyone away. Fantastic interview, absolutely fantastic. Catapulted his candidacy right to the top of the heap. There's no doubt in my mind. And so it's possible that, and I'm only speculating, that maybe people thought, okay, here we have Darryl Bazell, well-known, great background. Mm-hmm. We don't want any competition coming from the outside. I don't know. But she was the only outside candidate. There was one other local candidate that was very close to the university, mm-hmm. and whether you'd call him an insider or an outsider, I'd call him an insider. So she was truly from the outside. Mm-hmm. Fantastic. Anyway, that was my high-level search and screen experience. It was the only other time I'd ever really gone through anything at that level was when they hired Torfey. Glenn Watts was the budget officer and went off to New York. I was mid-career at that time, and I thought, well, I could be a candidate for that job. I'd been in my job long enough that it was time to look at something higher. And I applied for the position at UW-Whitewater and at and for the Watts position. And the committee ultimately, on this side, I was on the other end of the table. And I just found it interesting. I think they made the right choice. John Torfey was an absolutely phenomenal budget officer. He carried everything, you know, in his shirt pocket and up here. I never saw the man take a note. He was
really?
John Torfey didn't even, I don't know if he answered his own email. He was completely detached, as far as I could tell, from the computer. And yet he could get in front of a room and quote dollars, percentages, right down to the nth degree. The man was unbelievable. I mean, it's no wonder he achieved what he did. So they made the right choice. But my story is, in the course of being interviewed, I was asked by one of the committee members whether they felt I could be objective in this position coming from Cal's. Well, maybe that's a valid question. I don't know. Maybe that's asked in other areas. But to me, I think people migrate into positions and you don't carry personal agendas into these areas. I just found that to be a very insulting question. Anyway, that was my other experience with the search committee. Other things, gosh, there's a long laundry list of committees. A lot of them were campus level, student wage committee, a lot of equity and diversity. I served on the sexual harassment committee with Ted Finman.
Yeah, when was that? I think you ought to talk about that.
Yeah, that was a very interesting time.
Because sexual harassment emerged during your career from an issue that never had attention.
Right.
So when was that? When did that start to appear?
Gosh, you know, years in my mind are a blur, but it had to have been in the 70s. And we wrote the first sexual harassment policy. I mean, we had, as a committee, we had investigated and researched other areas, and this was the hot topic. And Ted had connections elsewhere as well.
He was from chemistry?
No, he was from law.
Law.
Yeah. We started putting something in writing, and we debated that language and wordsmithed that language as only a lawyer can do. You know, it was a very interesting concept. Absolutely fascinating. I enjoyed it.
How did you end up on that committee?
For years, I've been on the Equity and Diversity Committee for the college. I mean, when the chancellor in the early, gosh, it must have been the early 70s, mandated that every division have an Equity and Diversity Committee, I was put on it right away. And so I was involved in those kinds of things. I interacted with the personnel department and my role as Associate Dean for Administration. So I think I would get hooked into these. You know, Cal's was always considered one of the big four, LNS, engineering, med school, and Cal's.
Right.
And so committees like this, you usually the chancellor's office dipped into one or the other or more than one for representation on those kinds of committees.
Frank, when you went on the sexual harassment committee, were you, based on your previous work of equity and diversity, Were you aware of the depth and scope of the problem?
Oh, yeah. Our own Equity and Diversity Committee had dealt with gender equity. And that was a topic that was on the agenda for years prior to me going to Africa in 1990. The college had gone through a whole gender equity study. And that was very interesting, where we were required for every female faculty member to pick 3 to 4 what they considered to be peers in their own department if they could, but if they couldn't, in their own department, in a related department. And while that was very beneficial, it was quite stressful for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. I mean, first of all, in some cases, everyone has a high expectation for what they do and their performance. And if that isn't shared by your colleagues, it's a hard lesson to hear that, well, maybe you don't deserve what this other person is getting. Mm-hmm. So I had been involved in all those things within the college, never at the campus level, but even the Hayes Hill. While I wasn't on the Hayes Hill committee, we had many sessions with, I think it was Dennis Driesang that chaired that whole initiative with our own HR people.
And what was Hayes Hill?
Hayes Hill was when it became apparent that we needed an academic staff titling system. Where we had enough diversity and enough equity issues within the academic staff that we had to come up with a structure. And the Hayes Hill study, which was an outside consultant working with the university, put a whole titling and salary structure on academic staff. And that was another one of those monumental milestones in the course of this university when that happened. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, we had to all develop our own position description. So that was a component of that whole thing, because once the criteria was set for the titling structure, then you had to decide, well, where did you fit in that whole series? So you had to develop through a standard questionnaire, I think it was a 20-page questionnaire, your own duties and responsibilities. And the interesting thing is the wordsmithing in there really dictated where you fell on the scale. I mean, there's certain key words, I think we all know them now, mm-hmm. probably as a result of that whole exercise. But there were key action words that had to fit into these things for you to be placed in a position on this scale. Very interesting. I think another major committee is when we went through, the whole information system, a whole... it was a whole budget system and personnel system in the early 80s. I'm not even sure if that's on there because these are all kind of, you know, extra duty things where you were just called into session. Mm-hmm. I doubt that Hayes Hill is on my list.
No,
yeah,
it isn't.
Yeah. So these were things where you weren't...
Is this the Administrative Data Processing Advisory Committee?
Yes. And that took 2 years to really put into play. In the meantime, I think we talked about the Concerned Administrative Group, the CAG group.
Yes.
And, of course, this was a group that was meeting... privately outside any formal agenda, and these were all people that became well placed in university administration over the years. So, procurement committee, student wage committee, our academic planning council, our ag research stations committee, a lot of internal committees within the College of Agriculture and Life Sciences. Don't know if that catches everything, but.
Is it your judgment that this campus, UW-Madison, as compared to, say, some of the other Big Ten universities, has more committees and that there is more faculty involvement in all of that work? Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, I've never been on another campus, so I really can't compare us to anyone. I only know what I listen, what I pick up in my travels, what I hear from people that come here from other campuses. Mm-hmm. And this is always described as a unique place. A place where, well, at one time we called it faculty governance. Mm-hmm. Now I think we've got most people, not everyone, converted over to a term shared governance. But there's an expectation that there's a employee, faculty, staff input into virtually everything we do. And I think that is different and requires, you know, a lot of background work to be done before you just implement something. Probably the best example of that is what just happened on this campus with restructuring the grad school.
Yes, that seems to be a huge issue.
I think the cart got out in front of the horse on that one. And now they're having to circle back and bring everyone along. So I think there is a difference. Over the years, I've been involved in Kakubu and Nakubu. Nakubu is the National Association of College and University Business Officers.
Oh.
There are regional associations. So Kakubu is Central Association of College and University and Business Officers. Mm-hmm. There's a Wakubu, a Sakubu, and the Akubu. Mm-hmm. Each one representing their geographical area. Mm-hmm. Kakubu is the Midwest and is the eldest of all the associations, even preceding the National Association. And I've always been involved in that. We have our society meetings every year. Mm-hmm. So I would interact with my colleagues from other areas and get a feel for how things worked. And I always felt that many of these people were working in a top-down environment, and we don't do that here.
Right.
There's definitely a grassroots management structure to this place.
And Frank, isn't that the fundamental issue in the current brouhaha over Chancellor Martin and Provost DeLuca's attempt to create another vice chancellor for research, that will be top down on research rather than bottom up?
That's the fear. The fear is, while everyone is universal in their opinion that we need to do something,
uh-huh,
that the structure is broke. Something has to be done. And their immediate solution to this was to put in place a top dog, mm-hmm, without any idea of what needed to be done. And so people were very apprehensive. Well, how do you solve a problem by putting somebody in charge that's essentially going to implement things without really understanding the problem? Mm-hmm. So shared governance rose up and said, no, we're not going to accept that. Mm-hmm. Very interesting concept.
Yes, I've been surprised at the depth of feeling.
Oh, very emotional. I think it's pretty much throughout the vote of the Faculty Senate tells you something.
It was unanimous, wasn't it?
189-1. So there was one person in there But the rest of them, they always said, no, no, we're not going to do that yet. Tell us more before we submit to any kind of support for anything.
Frank, I want to return for a moment back to the search that produced Darryl Bazell as the chief administrative officer for the university. Do you think that search committees for campus-wide major positions are usually biased in favor of someone from Wisconsin or who has come up through the ranks?
The short answer to that is yes. There's a bias both ways. I think a lot of very capable people are killed in committee.
Candidates,
potential applicants that never survive the recruitment process simply because there's maybe a bias, just an opinion, something they've heard that takes them out of the running almost before they even get started. I mean, I've seen that in our own college as we search for deans. I think I've seen it at the university level as well. Now, I'm trying to remember her name, and I really thought she would have been an excellent provost. Gina
Shapiro. From political science.
Yeah.
Yeah, Frank, I know Gina, and I had enormous respect for her.
Absolutely.
And I was very surprised that she got the boot.
Got the boot in the search process.
And why was that?
Who knows? Who knows? I don't understand it. You know, there are those biases. You have people that feel that the time is right for someone from the outside. I think I wasn't on the search committee for Shalala, but obviously that was, evidently the time was right for her. Then there are times where I think some very capable outside candidates never get in because there's favoritism towards an inside candidate. I think that's the nature of search committees. At the end of the day, you hope you end up with a very strong short list, and the casualties are just going to have to accept their fate. I mean, the casualties that don't make that short list. And then you hope that when you really get a hard look at the shortlisted candidates, you have the kind of talent that you can feel comfortable with and that you can trust the judgment of the selection process, whether that's the Board of Regents in the case of a chancellor or the chancellor in the case of his or her staff and deans.
But Frank, I have been told because I'm knowledgeable about LNS, that John Wiley made it clear to the search and screen committee when Phil Certain stepped down that he wanted Gary Sandifer.
I haven't heard that directly, but there was a woman candidate in the mix, Mary Fitzpatrick, absolutely was shut out and just left us. And with hard feelings.
She went to the University of South Carolina, and she was a very impressive dean.
Very impressive. So, you know, it's an interesting process. You're going to have winners and you're going to have losers. And sometimes people that have made hard decisions throughout their career kind of take themselves out of the running when actually the final decisions are being made. There's enough hard feelings about some event or some decision that they're just rooted out right away.
So, Frank, this is very interesting. Is it fair for me to ask you a question about, or to ask your reaction about my suggestion that perhaps the internal workings of the university are far more Byzantine and complex than perhaps outsiders might think for the University of Wisconsin-Madison?
Yeah, certainly. And I don't know if this is typical of all academia. I've never seen a campus that, you know, that you can say you operate or function in the same manner that they do. I mean, we are, even though many of us are cut out of the same mold, land-grant universities, mm-hmm. nobody functions in a similar manner. Everyone has their own idiosyncrasies. So, but I think that's a true statement. It's very complex. And the management styles are different even between institutions. We have a couple departments in our college that are split between LNS or and Cal's or med school and Cal's. And they always say that the differences in how the two units are administered are almost night and day. The policies and business procedures are nowhere near similar. Mm-hmm. Each one has its own rules, quote unquote. Mm-hmm. Very interesting.
Mm-hmm. Are you, as you look back over your many years here, are you basically content and or pleased over how the university has operated?
Yeah. You know, just looking at the leadership, and we talked a little about the deans and Cal's, but if you look at the university leadership, I've always been very impressed by our chancellor selections. I remember I was in the first Kaufman seminar.
Oh.
Smith, initials, started it. Oh, what was his initial? He went by initials Smith. He's gone now, passed away. But he's the one that started it, which eventually became the Kaufman seminar. And I was in that first group, and it was a year-long session where we met once a week or once every other week. And when we got to our spring weekend, they brought in Don K. Smith was the Don K. Smith headed that up, the first one, and they brought in Donna Shalala from Hunter College. Wasn't she at Hunter in New York City?
She was.
Yeah. Fantastic woman. When she became, when it was announced that she was the selection, I was absolutely ecstatic. What a great hire that was. Now, I think her legacy is a very good one. She certainly put our athletic program on the map. I think you give her credit for that. She changed how we built buildings here. She was very energetic and very dedicated to fundraising and development. And that was.
So it's under her tenure that the buildings moved from 100% state funding to partial.
Absolutely. That was where it happened. And she said, I can leverage a lot more brick and mortar around here, state of Wisconsin, if you'll let me fund some of these buildings, but not penalize me for it. If I'm getting 35 to 40 million every biennium and I can come up with 30 or 40, I mean, let me have the 60 to 80, not you know, don't penalize my state appropriation. And we took off then. I mean, that's a whole change. Yet, I could be in a social function with her, and I just thought that she was not very hospitable. Mm-hmm. On a couple of occasions, I would meet her, say hello, and she'd be looking to see who else is around while she's talking to me. Mm-hmm. And her attention to the person that she was confronting was, I mean, it wasn't there.
That seems to be consistent over all the people I have talked to.
Yeah.
That there was no one more over your shoulder than Donna Shalala.
Exactly. While she was talking to you, she'd be looking around and looking where she was going to flight to next. I don't care if that's what you do, but when you're with me, okay, give me the courtesy of saying, hello, how are you? Our thing, I mean, and then excuse yourself and move on. I'd understand that, but to sit there and not focus, I always thought that was one of her largest flaws. Mm-hmm. Yet, very dynamic person. Probably didn't have a good track record on hiring deans. I think we've commented on that, but mm-hmm. Very good. David Ward, I could listen to him all day long.
Really?
Oh, I just thought he could come up in front of our group and just, I was always enthralled by him. John Wiley, I like John Wiley. He was a fine person, but I don't think that, he was not one of my favorites. I think all these people did great jobs, but the bottom line is we all have our strengths and we all have our weaknesses. Mm-hmm. I didn't think John ever really appreciated Cal's.
That was going to be my next question to you. How do you think the chancellors that you knew viewed Cal's?
The chancellors that I knew, the closest one that came to appreciating, in my mind, was David Ward. I think Donna Shalala knew what we could do, but she was a very politically savvy woman. Mm-hmm. And of course, she's the one that hired Roger Weiss. And I think she wanted Leo Walsh out, and she wanted to bring her own person that projected more her image, and I don't think that worked out at all, obviously. Mm-hmm. I think the first time I became aware of the relationship between our college and the university administration was really in the Irv Shane era. And I think, you know, Irv didn't have a lot of respect for Leo, so that was a problem.
That's right, you've addressed that earlier.
Yeah, and then Shalala came in, and I think she appreciated who we were and what we could do for her, but that's about as far as it went. And then, of course, she wanted new leadership, which ended up, she left then prior to Roger's five-year review, and he had alienated everyone else in Bascom by that time, Ward and Wiley. And so as soon as he stubbed his toe, that was the easy way out for him. Mm-hmm. I thought Ward kind of appreciated us. But I don't think John always, there was something in the back of John's mind, and I maybe it's just my perception, but he was from engineering. We had a small engineering department in our college. Mm-hmm. I think we always suspected that he didn't support our building program. We wanted to build a new building for that department, and I never went anywhere. I don't know.
It's interesting, as I listen to you, right now, it sounds like to me what you're saying is of Shane, Shalala, Ward, and Wiley, it's Ward who perhaps understood and appreciated the substance of cows.
I think so. That's exactly right. I think the others might have appreciated it, but for their own reasons or their own biases. And again, I don't have anything other than just my general feeling to back this up, but I really think that Irv didn't have any respect for Leo, and that was the major problem. Mm-hmm. I think Donna's appreciation for the college was all political and what we could do for her. I think Ward had a genuine appreciation, and I think Wiley was influenced by his sort of his competitive nature between engineering and Cal's. I don't know.
Yeah, it's interesting to go back for the moment to search and screen committees. A couple of well-placed faculty have intimated to me that John Wiley was not the best choice for chancellor when that happened, but that there was a certain momentum behind him.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, I knew John a little bit and liked him. But it's interesting. I think I hear you saying that perhaps John Wiley was maybe a little too parochial to be chancellor.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a fair statement. I don't know. There were times where, I mean, he was socially skilled. I'm not saying that he was not socially skilled, but he really didn't like that part of his chancellorship, I don't think. And I don't know, that was just the impression I had. So, Biddy Martin, I don't know. I think the jury's still out on that appointment.
Is she here a year yet?
Just about. Yeah, just about a year.
Mm-hmm.
It's coming up, I think. And again, outside, top-down kind of stuff. From our standpoint, and from my personal opinion, for our college, and maybe for the university, I think the jewel that they lost was wouldn't you know, I'd have a mental block, it's going to come to me. But he left us and went out to Cal Berkeley, our biochemist. He was in Egg Hall as the executive associate dean. You know, you get one of these mental blocks and you should know the name. It'll come to me. But once the name comes to me, he stepped in. Bob Burrish was the, many years ago, was appointed by Roger Weiss to do the long-range planning study.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time, this person, whose name is mentally blocked now, served as the co-chair because the senior statesman was very elderly at that time, and really Bob Burris was already into his late 70s, late 70s. So he stepped in and really co-chaired the whole planning process, and as a result, knew exactly every skeleton in our closet.
Mm-hmm.
Very decisive person, very organized. And got an offer to go elsewhere. and wanted to maybe come back as the dean. Well, when he didn't even make the search process, he was one that was cut out of the herd early. Now he's at Texas A&M and doing very well. Gosh, why is that name not there? I mean, I worked with him for 6 years. This is embarrassing.
Happens all the time.
Yeah.
This is, you're not the first.
Okay.
Let me just.
Yeah. So I think he would have been a great grad school dean. He would have been a great dean for our college. And never quite made it back here, which is too bad. Now, I mean, he's a, basically a chancellor. Well, he's a dean, no, provost at Texas A&M.
Oh.
And would be an excellent person to come here. Paul, it's going to come back slowly. Anyway, what else do you have?
I'd like you to comment a little further on your impression of Biddy Martin and the process that brought in a non-Wisconsin person this time. Was it a good thing, for instance, to bring someone from Cornell, which is both land grant and private?
Mm-hmm. By the way, the name came to me, Paul Ludden.
Ludden,
L-U-D-D-E-N. And Paul was an early candidate for the chancellor's position here.
This time?
Mm-hmm. I think he was had his name in and was, from just what I heard, was eliminated early in the process. And why that is, I don't know. A case of maybe the Aggies on the selection committee felt that, you know, he was too life science oriented. I don't know. I don't have any idea. But Aberle brought Ludden into his administration from the life science side.
Oh.
Because of the stress between the ag community and the life science community.
Uh-huh.
And Aberle, as you know, was the animal scientist from Nebraska.
Right.
And he brought in Ludden to really kind of bridge that gap. And maybe there were some hard feelings there. But anyway, I don't know what went on in that committee. Biddy Martin, I'm told from people on the committee, really interviewed well. A lot like Molly John and how she interviewed for the position of dean.
And Molly's from Cornell, too.
She's from
wasn't
Cornell
she?
As well, right? You just hear rumors, but apparently there wasn't a whole lot of collegiality between those two at Cornell. But I don't think it was a problem. Molly was basically a professor, wasn't a department chair. I think she did some committee work, but she didn't really have an administrative background. So what their relationship was there, I don't know. I'm not sure their relationship is all that well here. But of course, Molly's off now with her appointment in Washington.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what the applicant pool was like. I know had Paul Ludden been a finalist, I would have been supporting him hands mm-hmm. down. Irwin Goldman, the vice dean, was a candidate for provost, and I really supported his candidacy. I've known Paul DeLuca a long time, and I really admire Paul DeLuca. My concern over Paul was not his ability to do the job, but I always considered him more of an administrative background in the School of Medicine.
Is he a physician or an administrator?
Administrator. I think he chaired a department at one time, but I don't think he was, I'm not sure. I don't think he was ever tenured faculty.
Mm.
Maybe he was, I don't know. But his role, for as long as I've known him, has been in the administration of the med school. So I didn't know how that background would fit into a provost position. Maybe that's part of the problem. I don't know.
Well, it is interesting when you think about DeLuca and the medical school and the affect that generally surrounds physicians of being in charge.
Well, and I think the culture in the med school is far different than the rest of the university, because you've got clinical professors out there. You've got more of a top-down mentality, at least from what I can tell. That doesn't exist in our college. I think it's a lot easier to bring someone in from the outside into that culture, and they're more authoritarian.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And if he brought that to Bascom, then that, I think Paul's a quick learner. I mean, I think he can turn things around in a hurry, but their problem over this grad school dean was going to be a top-down kind of thing, and that's Paul working with Biddy and not understanding the whole environment here. Mm-hmm. And yet he's an insider. So we'll see how it works.
Have you had much to do with Biddy Martin yet?
No.
I interviewed Dick Barrows from Cal's. Now, he at one point was acting provost, I think, or
yes,
interim provost.
Right. Prior to coming back to the college.
Right. But he decided he didn't want to do that.
Yeah.
Do you think he would have made a good provost?
Not a great provost, not a bad provost.
Uh-huh.
Dick was really good in our college. I liked him as dean of our undergraduate programs.
Uh-huh.
He always had management by objective mentality about everything. About the time that was kind of wearing out, he was the strong proponent of that. And I'm not sure he would have carried that, if he would have carried that management philosophy into the provost position, I think it would have been really a difficult road. Mm-hmm. When he became dean, he used a lot of that in his own administration and his own staff. And of course, I knew all those people well, and while they accepted that, they never really, in my mind, bought into it. It was kind of, you know, a hallway kind of, well, you know, we're off doing this again, with little sticky notes and things. So I don't know.
Uh-huh.
He would not have been a failure, but I'm not sure he would have been. I always liked Bernie Cohen as provost. I always really admired him.
Now, you know, Frank, that is so interesting, because again, you are in the mainstream of faculty who talk about Bernie Cohen. I have yet to hear a negative comment about Bernie Cohen.
Super guy, super administrator. I give him high marks. Yeah.
And it's not that people avoid negatives. They generally express positive mm-hmm. respect for Bernie Cohen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep, he was a good one.
Now, Frank, when you say he was a good one, I want to press you a little bit. What does good mean? How would you explicate that?
Well, I always, first of all, they're all smart. I mean, you're not going to get to that level without having a pretty good head on your shoulders. I always thought that he functioned and communicated well. You always, you know, whereas if Donna Shalala had a fault over interpersonal skills, Bernie was very genuine, you know, very engaging. Think he worked well. I never worked for him, but just from what I could see, he really depended on his staff, delegated well, managed well. I just had the highest respect for the man.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Now, what is the nature of the relationship of the provost to various college deans? Do the deans report to the provost, or do they report directly to the chancellor?
I think that varies by administration. Now, I've heard Molly say, I work for the chancellor. I might report through the provost, but I work for the chancellor. And, of course, her departments and her faculty. But I think there's been, depending on how they wanted to organize their staff, I mean, there's been times where the deans have really reported to the provost, and then there are times where deans report right to the chancellor. And it really depends on the chancellor and how he or she wants to run things.
But the chancellor makes all the dean appointments, doesn't the chancellor?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. I thought Bernie had a lot of respect within the staff and with, you know, with the whole group up there. Names are always escaping me. The person who went to Arizona, the provost that was, really with the Wiley. Another name that's gone.
It's interesting about Bernie, though. I interviewed Martha Casey, who was a budget officer,
yes,
I think, in Vasco.
But,
and she worked with a lot of provosts, and she said Bernie Cohen was by far her favorite and stood head and shoulders above all the other provosts.
I agree with Martha on that. Yeah. The other person that I probably interacted with, if we're on chancellors, was Len Van Ness. We've talked about him in the past.
Mm-hmm.
Len was an icon in Bascom Hall for many, many years, through the Shane era. I think he fell out of favor when Shalala got here. Len's role was, and he was very well versed in virtually everything, but his role was to be kind of the devil's advocate on everything, lay out the pluses, the minuses, you know, how this. And he was very good at that. Donna had no use for that. I think she wanted
approach.
Yeah, she wanted him out of there from almost the time she got here. And the person that she hired to replace Leo, Roger Weiss, had the same impression of Len. And yet Len was a very skilled administrator. Really had a lot of institutional knowledge, but that kind of CEO type really didn't put up with that.
You know, I'd like you to talk a little more about Len Van Ness, and the reason, it's quite selfish on my part, he has adamantly refused to be interviewed for oral history under no circumstances. Art Hovey has talked to him, I have written him several times.
It's too bad.
A number of people have said just what you did about, yeah, you know, how skilled he was, how talented he was, and that Donna wanted him out and threw him out, literally.
And so did Roger.
That's right. He came down to, mm-hmm,
And Roger threw him out. And he, I mean, it's just so typical of that kind of CEO attitude. And yet, the reason that Len will never probably interview is he's too much of a class act. He won't come in here and badmouth either of them. Uh-huh. That's just his nature. I mean, he is so dedicated to this institution, and he would refuse to criticize any of them, I think, on tape. And that's why he doesn't want to be interviewed. There are certain areas, if you did get him before a microphone, it would be on the condition that you not go here or there. Uh-huh. He'd get to a point and say, I'm not going to talk about that.
Are you and he friends?
Oh, yeah. Not close. I mean, you don't work around here as long as I did in the role. I interacted with Len all the time. Len took over my job.
Uh-huh.
I mean, finally, Shalala asked Neil Jorgensen to take Van Ness when she first got here, and I was in Africa then, and Neil called me and said, well, what do you think? I said, don't do it. I said, I don't think that he would necessarily fit in well, and he was a good friend, but I just didn't see him in that role. Maybe I was trying to protect my own job, too. I don't know. But then when that fell through, and when Donna hired Roger accepted Len because Roger or Donna asked him to. And he just said, sure, no problem. Well, when he got here, then he had the same problem with Len that Donna did. Mm-hmm. Len was kind of, like I say, the devil's advocate on everything. He would lay out everything in a very, you had a column for reasons why and a reasons why not. Mm-hmm. And I don't think they had the patience to deal with that kind of management style. And so Roger came to me one day and said, well, would you come down and take your old job back? Well, nothing was going on internationally, and I said, why? Well, he said, I've asked Len to leave. And it was very poorly done. I mean, the announcement went out to the staff without Len even really realizing that it had gotten that far. Yeah, he was very upset, and I don't blame him. Mm-hmm. I don't blame him. He was not dealt with fairly.
Frank, I can't recall, actually, if we've talked about it a whole lot, but certainly the 80s and 90s, when you've been involved here, the university has faced enormous budget cuts. Mm-hmm. Year after year after year. Mm-hmm. What's your comment about that and the impact that that's had on the university?
Wow, it's been, you know, the, how do I want to respond to that? From the outside looking in, they're probably saying, gosh, that was easy. And, you know, I guess to any outsider looking in, it was. The general attitude is that, well, they've got money. They've got other sources. Mm-hmm. There's tuition. And yet you try to implement some of those revenue streams, and then you get crossways with the general public. But I think it's really changed. That's been part of the change with the university. There's no doubt that I've said several times our faculty are very entrepreneurial. Mm-hmm. They've got to be. We can't hire anyone that isn't exceptionally on top of their game and has the capacity to go out and generate funds, because we need those funds. I've always said our budget is built on a house of cards now, because we've got
that's a house of cards. What do you mean?
Well, what happens if we don't have the kind of extramural support that we have right now? We only have 17% of our budget based on state funds, and technically that includes tuition to some extent. The majority of our operating funds are based on overhead. That's how we pay the lights. That's how we pay the heating bill.
Oh, on overhead from the research grants.
Yeah. If suddenly, well, the federal government and the compliance agencies pretty much look to the East and West Coast. If you hear of a university that's in trouble for whatever, for financial management, it's someone out there. We have been relatively clean. I think we're well managed. But if ever we ran into a problem where we were put on probation for compliance shortcomings or mismanagement, and that funding tide turned against us, it's over. We need that indirect cost money to survive. Mm-hmm. Now, I suppose any institution, we're not the only state institution that isn't in financial trouble or isn't depending on federal overhead to carry the day, but that's a real problem. So that's been a major change. We now, our master is really federal funding, and being flexible enough to move into new areas of science and staying current, that's pretty significant.
Do you foresee the day when state funding might return to a higher percentage?
Nope.
Is that over?
Over. We can't even think about that anymore. When you start looking at welfare and health plans and the penal system, there's no way. We're at the end of the list. Mm-hmm. In spite of how this state has valued education, we're never going to get back to that. We just need to forget about it.
Do you think the 17% will continue to decline?
Mm-hmm.
Really?
Yeah. Maybe it will hold steady there. I don't think it's going to go below 10. That would be, but I don't think it's never going to grow back, and I think it'll slip a little more. Tuition is going to help that. Ultimately, we're going to have to raise tuition to stay competitive. That's going to be an ongoing thing.
So the days of a world-class university at very accessible tuition costs is also over.
Yeah, right. I think we're a bargain right now.
Even with the recent increases?
Mm-hmm. We are still a bargain. Anyone that, the quality of education, the quality of student, the amount of opportunities you have for rubbing elbows with world-class scientists is just a real bargain at our tuition costs. Now, a lot of other institutions claim to have a lot of research prowess as well, but for where we are as public institutions in the top one or two or four or whatever it is, you just can't find that in the Midwest anywhere else. So we're a bargain.
Franks, what's going to happen to Cal's over the next half century?
I think it's got all the potential with the right leadership to really become something special. We don't do much in the way of applied stuff anymore. We're pretty basic.
And those days won't come back.
Even, you know, if you date back to our earliest roots, it was the basic kind of science dealing with applied problems that really provided, you know, scientific breakthroughs that just didn't happen anywhere else. I think the culture here will always perpetuate that and will become a science-based, a research-based institution. And Cal's has all the potential to develop in that area, even with our applied departments. As I said, we're basically wet lab in most of our departments now. In some of our plant science departments, we're more dry lab. Mm-hmm. But that's all changed. Mm-hmm. So I think there's the potential here to really be something when you get into environmental areas or the life science areas, genetic issues, it's nutrition. Mm-hmm. We're the people that can do it. Now, it's over in med school as well, but most of the human health, human nutrition science is right in our college. I think we're well positioned. Mm-hmm.
And you're confident that Cal's, even as it evolves, will remain one of the central pillars of the UW-Madison?
Yes. Yeah.
You don't see that modifying or diminishing?
Well, you know, if you take this out as far as possible, sustaining the human population on this planet is focused right in our college, mm-hmm. feeding people.
Right.
Learning new techniques to feed the population. That's all in our college. So I think we're going to be around for a long time. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Are you ready?
Yeah.
Frank, as this interview moves toward its conclusion, any closing observations from you?
I just want to say that it's been my privilege to be associated with this university. I mean, I had no idea early in my life that this was going to happen, but it's been 40 years. I mean, I left once thinking I'd never come back, and fate brought me back. But I've had the privilege of, a 40-year association with this university. I have had the opportunity to be at the executive management level. I've had the privilege of making contributions, albeit them small, but it's been fun. Now, I'm unfortunately at the end of that career, mm-hmm. really have a lot more to give. I don't intend on quitting And I really think I have high hopes and strong indications that I'm going to move back into the international arena, carrying an emeritus university business card. So I see this as a stepping stone into my a career that was really born in the 1980s with a 5-year stint in Africa and subsequent consulting in the years that followed. So where would I have gotten that opportunity anywhere else?
It's quite extraordinary, actually.
It's unbelievable.
I mean, this is not to take away from your talents, but when I think about a teenager in Sharon, Wisconsin, milking maybe 25 cows, to now, a figure in the international world within a, you know, a well-defined, it is quite an extraordinary journey.
Well, you know, in this international work, I had the opportunity to sit and visit with the president of Bangladesh for an hour, one-on-one with him and his wife. Gosh, where would I have had that opportunity anywhere else? Now, I got that because of the University of Wisconsin. He's a PhD from our soil science department.
Oh, is he?
Yeah, and he's president of Bangladesh. And while I was there working with a couple of professors, they said, you know, I'm working at an institution that is really under the auspices of the president's wife. And we know he's from Wisconsin. Could we get you together with him and talk about, and we had a full hour, just the president, his wife, and my colleague and I, one-on-one talking about her institution and various aspects. I mean, that's fantastic.
Frank, do you think that opportunity, the transformative influence of the UW-Madison exists for those 18-year-old kids still today who might be the equivalent of who you were back in the late 50s, early 60s?
Boy, it's hard to say because, you know, we ebb and flow with our commitment to international work. My sense right now is that this institution is not going to have the kind of global commitment that exists in other places. Arizona, Michigan State, Harvard, these are some of the, even Illinois, I think, have a much stronger commitment to international work. So, you know, back to your question, will other 18-year-olds have maybe the same opportunity I did? First of all, not many people had the opportunity that I did. Some of my old friends are always a bit envious of the opportunity I've had to travel internationally. I mean, I've worked in Bangladesh, Malawi, Thailand, Africa, even parts of Europe, the Soviet bloc, on a couple occasions through there. So, but given where we're going with international programs on this campus, I'm not sure that many people will have the opportunity that I had. Mm-hmm. Don't think it's going to happen.
Inclusion. Yeah. This now concludes the oral history interview with the distinguished and also engaging Frank Kustra.
More engaging than distinguished.
Well, we can debate that. Yeah. But thank you, Frank.